This is Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio for January the 21st. I'm Steve Scully. We're glad you're with us. Here are some of your Thursday headlines. President Joe Biden signing 10 executive orders today to take charge of the country's response to coronavirus. Yesterday alone, more than 4,100 Americans died from COVID-19. The overall death toll in this country has exceeded 400,000. The Biden administration also ordering the creation of federal vaccination sites at facilities, including stadiums, while also directing more funding to state and local health departments. This comes as a number of American cities warning they are running out of vaccines. We did learn today that Pfizer and Moderna are scheduled to ship more than 8.5 million doses next week, but it may not be enough to meet the growing demand. Also, Christopher Wray will stay on as the FBI director with more than 6 years left in his 10-year term. The director, appointed by President Trump, had been facing questions on his future. Earlier today, White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki saying that the president has, quote, confidence in Director Wray. The story shaping Washington today. It's all ahead here on C-SPAN Radio. And we begin on Capitol Hill as the talks continue between the Senate leaders on a power-sharing agreement. With the Senate evenly divided, 50 Democrats and 50 Republicans, Senator Mitch McConnell of Kentucky and Senator Chuck Schumer of New York have yet to figure out how the Senate will run, with Vice President Kamala Harris giving the Democrats a slight edge. She, of course, has the tie-breaking vote. Now, keep in mind, the Senate has been in this position before. It was 20 years ago this month, at the start of the George W. Bush administration, that there was also a 50-50 split. Of course, then the Republicans held the edge. The Democratic and Republican Senate leaders are using that as a potential template for their current talks. The deal would govern the number of senators from each party on committees, would likely allow bills to get to the Senate floor even on an evenly split votes in committees, and may even give Senator McConnell some rights on the Senate floor, rights that he would not otherwise have if the Democrats had 51 senators. We begin with Democratic leader, now in the majority, Chuck Schumer.
Our country has suffered deeply from a chaotic, lackluster, and incompetent federal response to COVID-19. As we cross the grim milestone of 400,000 American fatalities from COVID, the Biden administration is wasting no time in marshaling the resources of the federal government into action, and today released a national strategy to defeat the pandemic. What a concept. A president who actually takes the defining crisis of our time seriously. What a change. And how great is the need. Here in the Senate, the first order of business is to fulfill our constitutional duty to advise and consent on the president's appointments to his cabinet. Last night, the Senate confirmed the president's selection for the Director of National Intelligence, Avril Haines. We appreciate the bipartisan cooperation to get her confirmation done yesterday, and we should continue in that spirit today. Traditionally, the Senate has confirmed several national security nominees for an incoming administration during their first few days. Even as power changes hands from one administration to the other, the work of keeping our nation safe must not be paused or be disrupted. Foreign adversaries will seek to exploit this period of transition, and we cannot allow America's military, intelligence, and national security policy to be disrupted by staffing delays. In 2017, President Trump had his Defense Secretary and Secretary of Homeland Security in place on Inauguration Day. President Biden deserves his national security team in place as soon as possible, as well as key officials in charge of responding to the current health and economic crises. With the cooperation of our Republican colleagues, we can and should confirm the Secretaries of Defense, State, Homeland Security, and Treasury without much delay. While national security is paramount, I'd remind my colleagues we're in the middle of an economic crisis. The sooner we confirm a Treasury Secretary, the better. And so, as we begin the process of bringing our country back together, let the first week of this Congress be a collaboration between our two parties to confirm President Biden's cabinet.
And of course, you can continue to follow those Senate votes on the confirmation process into the evening live on C-SPAN 2. That from Senator Chuck Schumer. Meanwhile, Republican leader Mitch McConnell indicating that a major hang-up on those talks over how the Senate will be structured is his request that there be an assurance from Democrats not to get rid of the legislative filibuster. That, of course, is the requirement that bills clear a 60-vote procedural hurdle before a final up or down vote. More from the Senate floor with Mitch McConnell.
For this 117th Congress, the American people chose an evenly split Senate, 50 Republicans and 50 Democrats. With the election of Vice President Harris, that means the Democratic leader will act as majority leader. So I want to congratulate my colleague from New York. His pride and emotion were palpable yesterday as this self-described kid from Brooklyn and son of an exterminator and a housewife became the first Jewish member of Congress to lead either chamber, an historic milestone. Now, the Senate's handled an even split before. 20 years ago, faced with the same scenario, the two leaders brokered a power-sharing agreement so the institution could function smoothly. The Democrat leader and I are discussing a similar agreement now. I've been heartened to hear my colleagues say he wants the same rules from the 2000s to apply today. Because certainly 20 years ago, there was no talk, none whatsoever, of tearing down longstanding minority rights on legislation. The legislative filibuster is a crucial part of the Senate. Leading Democrats like President Biden himself have long defended it. Democrats themselves just spent 6 years using it literally to block bills from Senator Tim Scott's police reform to coronavirus relief. And less than 4 years ago, when it was Republicans who held the Senate, the House, and the presidency, 27 current Democrats, plus Vice President Hyde Harris, signed a letter insisting this longstanding rule should not be broken. So if the talk of unity and common ground is to have meaning, and certainly if the rules from 20 years ago are to be our guide, then I cannot imagine the Democratic leader would rather hold up the power-sharing agreement than simply reaffirm that his side won't be breaking this standing rule of the Senate. I appreciate our ongoing good faith discussions and look forward to finding the solution together.
From the Senate floor earlier today, and joining us on the phone is congressional reporter Mike DeBonis of The Washington Post. Let me begin with the timeline as we look at this evenly divided Senate. When do you think negotiations will be wrapped up between the two leaders?
Well, Steve, that is a very big question. I don't have a good answer to it. It seems that they are closer to the beginning of the negotiation than the end at this point. I think there's pretty good consensus on the Democratic side that they're not in any mood to make any concessions to Mitch McConnell, who, you know, lost his majority in the January 5th Georgia runoff elections. But it seems to me that the Republicans are eager to exact some sort of concession from Democrats as they enter into this new 50-50 era. And it seems like it's going to take some time to work that out. Whether that's going to be a matter of days or weeks, I think, remains to be seen. But I think there's not much hope of this being done this week.
So give us a sense of what will happen in the interim, especially with the committee assignments.
So basically, the committees will continue under their previous constituencies in the Republican majority. Technically, the Republicans will remain the chairman until the committees are reconstituted under the new resolution. And that obviously has implications for some of these nominations that are coming through for the Biden administration. So far, the reality is if there's going to be any confirmations, it's going to take unanimous consent of all 100 senators to bring those directly to the floor and bypass the committee process. If there are any of these are at all controversial. They're going to be in limbo until some sort of arrangement is worked out.
Is there a blueprint? We've been talking about what happened 20 years ago when we also had a 50-50 Senate back in 2001. Will that provide the roadmap for these two leaders?
Certainly for Chuck Schumer, his hope is that it is the roadmap. It is. He's made statements saying that he'd be very pleased with a carbon copy of the 2001 agreement. However, that's not what Mitch McConnell is saying. Mitch McConnell, I think, is saying in so many words that was a different era. It was a less partisan era in the Senate. The filibuster was not in serious peril. You didn't have as many Democrats as you do now suggesting that it should be discarded. And he thinks that this is a good issue to rally his conference around and pick an early fight with Democrats on. And I think that's a good, great deal of his thinking is about getting unity in his own ranks against this new Democratic majority.
And of course, we should point out that's when Dick Cheney, the vice president, a Republican, held the tie-breaking vote. Reminding our listeners, we're talking with Mike DeBonis of The Washington Post. Let's turn real quickly to the House and this statement earlier today by Republican leader Kevin McCarthy on some dissension among House Republicans over the number three leader in the House, Liz Cheney, the representative from Wyoming who voted to impeach President Trump earlier this month.
You know, what's different within our party and maybe with others, people have difference of opinion. We will have a conference next week. We won't air it to the public, but we'll answer the questions everybody has. This is the same leadership team with the ranking members and others that came five seats away from winning a majority when everybody in America thought we were going to lose 20 seats. Yes, we allow differences of opinion inside our conference. They're welcomed. But I think there's questions that need to be answered, style in which things were delivered. At the end of the day, we will unify because our policies are right, which will unify us around. Do we have growing pains? Yes, we will. But we will do it in our private manner of a conference that we hold every time, and we'll have it next week. Yes, sir.
Liz Cheney to remain as conference chair or no?
Yes.
That from the House Republican leader, Kevin McCarthy of California. Mike DeBonis, what questions are arising within the GOP conference?
Well, they're among the core of hardcore Trump loyalists, particularly members of the House Freedom Caucus. There have been very vocal since Liz Cheney came out strongly for President Trump's impeachment that she is no longer fit to serve as a party leader. That said, this is a small rump among a nearly 200 member caucus, more than 200 member caucus at this point. It really remains unclear whether they have the votes or the wherewithal to follow through with ousting her. And, I think what you heard Leader McCarthy say is you heard him acknowledge that there's, dismay with the way that, if not with what she said, but the way she said it. And I think he suggested what he was suggesting is that, there needs to be an opportunity for those members to, for lack of a better way of putting it, blow off some steam, share their feelings, and give Congresswoman Cheney a chance to respond in a private forum with her colleagues. What my reporting is indicating is that there's some expectation that may be enough to sort of bring down the temperature on this a bit. That in the passage of time, past the impeachment, past the events of January 6th, past President Trump's departure from the White House, I think that there's a lot of hope that that's going to kind of, everyone's going to say their piece and move on.
And we learned just yesterday that she will face a primary challenge in her home state of Wyoming in 2022, next year.
That's right. A state senator announced yesterday that he will be challenging her for the Republican nomination in Wyoming in 2022. Hearing different things about how serious this candidate should be taken, there's a possibility that other Republicans may step forward. But in either case, I think that this is certainly too early to sign a political death warrant for Liz Cheney. The Cheney family obviously has roots in Wyoming going back decades, certainly to her father's time in the House. And I think that she's going to bring enormous resources to bear to any campaign. And I think that, you know, it's also important to know that in Wyoming, you know, you can win the nomination with a plurality of votes. If there's a number of challengers, she wouldn't necessarily even have to win a majority. So these are things we're going to be watching as this campaign cycle plays out.
And our listeners can follow your reporting at WashingtonPost.com and in the newspaper. Mike DeBonis, thank you for being with us.
Thanks, Steve.
And also on Capitol Hill today, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi telling reporters that the House and Senate are ready to proceed with former President Trump's second impeachment trial. But she did indicate that transmission of those articles is being held up by questions over how the trial actually would work. More from her regular Thursday news conference.
The Senate will be ready for the trial of the then President of the United States for his role in instigating an insurrection on the House, on the Capitol of the United States, on our democracy, to undermine the will of the people. It's very clear his has been on this path for a while, but that just that day, he roused the troops. He urged them on to fight like hell. He sent them on their way to the Capitol. He called upon lawlessness. He showed a path to the Capitol, and the lawlessness took place. A direct connection in one day over and above all of the other statements he had made before. So in any event, I'm not going to be telling you when it is going, but we had to wait for the Senate to be in session. They've now informed us they're ready to receive. The question is, are there questions about how a trial will proceed? But we are ready.
That's from Speaker Pelosi. Now, during her first White House briefing last night, Press Secretary Jen Psaki denying that the impeachment trial poses a problem for pursuing President Joe Biden's agenda, calling for unity and bipartisanship. And Speaker Pelosi also dismissing Republican concerns that impeachment could divide lawmakers so soon after the inauguration.
You mentioned unity and the message of unity that came out yesterday. Are you at all concerned about moving forward with an impeachment trial could undercut that message and alienate Republican supporters of the president?
No. No, I'm not worried about that. The fact is, the president of the United States committed an act of incitement of insurrection. I don't think it's very unifying to say, oh, let's just forget it and move on. That's not how you unify. Joe Biden said it beautifully. If you're going to unite, you must remember. And we must bring this in. And it, look, that's our responsibility, to uphold the integrity of the Congress of the United States. That's our responsibility, to protect and defend the Constitution of the United States. And that is what we will do. And just because he's now gone, thank God, that you don't say to a president, do whatever you want in the last months of your administration. You're going to get a get-out-of-jail card free because people think we should make nice and forget that people died here on January 6th, that the attempt to undermine our election, to undermine our democracy, to dishonor our Constitution. No, I don't see that at all. I think that would be harmful to unity.
That's from House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. Meanwhile, the Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell planning to present a proposal to the Democratic leader to delay the start of any impeachment trial by former President Trump until sometime in February. The specific date is TBD. According to a story posted a short while ago at CBSNews.com, this would give impeachment managers and the former president's defense team at least a week to prepare. Senator McConnell floating the proposal during a conversation with Republican senators on a conference call earlier today. Now in the minority, he does not have final say on when a trial would be. Senator Schumer would have to agree to the proposal. And as we indicated at the top of the program, Senate operations now at the top of the agenda for Democratic and Republican leaders trying to work that through. Here is more with Senator Chuck Schumer.
Can you update us a little bit on the schedule? Do you expect the articles of impeachment to come today, tomorrow? And can you tell us about the nomination? Do you expect any nomination votes tonight?
Let me try to answer both of those. First, Speaker Pelosi will determine when she will send the articles over. Leader McConnell and I are trying to come up with a bipartisan agreement on how to conduct the trial. But make no mistake about it, there will be a trial. There will be a vote up or down on whether to convict the president. I believe he should be convicted. And we'll have to wait till she sends the articles over to figure out how to do all that.
That's from the Senate Democratic leader, Chuck Schumer of New York. Meanwhile, seven Senate Democrats are urging the Ethics Committee to open an investigation into Republican Senator Josh Hawley of Missouri and Ted Cruz of Texas in response to the January 6th Capitol riots. The senator is filing a complaint with the committee asking that it probe whether Senators Hawley and Cruz's objections to the Electoral College violated the chamber's ethics rules. It reads in part, quote, "The Senate Ethics Committee should investigate their conduct to fully understand their role, the actions of which we know demand an investigation and a determination whether disciplinary action is warranted. Until then, a cloud of uncertainty will hang over them and over this body." Now, both Republican senators are potential 2024 presidential contenders. Even after those deadly demonstrations in and around the Capitol 2 weeks ago, both senators, Josh Hawley and Ted Cruz, objected to the Electoral College results from Arizona and from Pennsylvania. You're listening to Washington Today. And welcome back. This is Washington Today for Thursday, January 21st. Here are some of your other headlines. The president appointing Rebecca Kelly Slaughter to serve as the acting chair of the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission. A number of reports indicating it is a move that positions the watchdog agency to take on a more aggressive role in policing Facebook, Google, and other tech giants in Silicon Valley. And the Washington Post has some of the very first pictures of the Oval Office under the new Biden administration. You'll notice the bust of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and Senator Robert F. Kennedy next to the fireplace in the office. Behind the Resolute desk is a bust of Cesar Chavez, as well as Rosa Parks and Eleanor Roosevelt. And on the wall, paintings of Benjamin Franklin, George Washington, and Abraham Lincoln. The deep blue rug is from the Clinton administration. All the changes took place yesterday after the Trumps left the White House in the morning and just prior to the Biden's arrival shortly before 4 p.m. in the afternoon. More details and pictures available at WashingtonPost.com. In today's White House briefing, an update on COVID-19 from Dr. Anthony Fauci. In addition to his role as the leading infectious disease expert at NIH, Dr. Fauci has a new role as President Biden's chief medical advisor. Now, back in November, Dr. Fauci admitted that working alongside the Trump administration was, in his words, quote, very stressful. Today, New York Times White House reporter Michael Shear asking what it's like in the new Biden administration.
Dr. Fauci, you've joked a couple times today already about the difference in that you feel in being kind of the spokesperson for this issue in this administration versus the previous one. Can you talk a little bit about how free, how much different do you feel, less constrained? What is the, you know, I mean, you for so many times you stood up behind the podium with Donald Trump standing behind you. That was a different feeling, I'm sure, than it is today. Can you talk a little bit about how you feel kind of released from what you had been doing for the last year?
Yeah, but you said I was joking about it. I was very serious about it. I wasn't joking. No, actually, obviously, I don't want to be going back, you know, over history, but it was very clear that there were things that were said, be it regarding things like hydroxychloroquine and other things like that, that really was an uncomfortable because they were not based on scientific fact. I can tell you, I take no pleasure at all in being in a situation of contradicting the president. So it was really something that you didn't feel that you could actually say something and there wouldn't be any repercussions about it. The idea that you can get up here and talk about what you know, what the evidence, what the science is, and know that's it. Let the science speak. It is somewhat of a liberating feeling.
Basically vanished for a few months there for a while. You feel like you're back now?
I think so.
Well,
okay.
That's Mike Scheer. You don't want to take questions from him. Thank you, Dr. Fauci, so much for joining us. We really appreciate it, and we'll have him back again. So
thank you.
That from today's White House briefing, and you heard Jen Psaki refer to Michael Scheer of the New York Times, who posed that question. Also today, the U.S. back in the World Health Organization, the WHO. Dr. Fauci announcing earlier today that the U.S. will fulfill its financial obligations to the organization and will end what was a drawdown of U.S. staff who worked within the organization that began under the Trump administration. In response, the executive director of the WHO wrote on Twitter, quote, "Thank you, my brother Tony, for leading the delegation." More from this morning's video conference.
I join my fellow representatives in thanking the World Health Organization for its role in leading the global public health response to this pandemic. Under trying circumstances, this organization has rallied the scientific and research and development community to accelerate vaccines, therapies, and diagnostics, conducted regular streamed press briefings that authoritatively track global developments, provided millions of vital supplies from lab reagents to protective gear to healthcare workers in dozens of countries, and relentlessly worked with nations in their fight against COVID-19. I also know firsthand the work of WHO, with whom I have engaged in a collaborative manner, touching all aspects of global health over the past four decades. And as such, I am honored to announce that the United States will remain a member of the World Health Organization. Yesterday, President Biden signed letters retracting the previous administration's announcement to withdraw from the organization. And those letters have been transmitted to the Secretary General of the United Nations and to you, Dr. Tedros, my dear friend. In addition to retracting the notification of withdrawal and retaining membership in the WHO, the United States will cease the drawdown of United States staff seconded to the WHO and will resume regular engagement of U.S. government personnel with the WHO both directly and through our WHO collaborating centers. The United States also intends to fulfill its financial obligations to the organization. The United States sees technical collaboration at all levels as a fundamental part of our relationship with WHO, one that we value deeply and will look to strengthen going forward.
That from Dr. Anthony Fauci earlier today. He, of course, is the nation's leading expert on infectious diseases at NIH. And on this first full day of his administration, the president releasing his national strategy to end the COVID-19 pandemic, one of his first executive orders including a mask mandate at all federal buildings and properties. The administration is also looking at ways to use the Defense Production Act to speed up the manufacturing of vaccine supplies, including syringes. More from President Biden's announcement from the state dining room of the White House.
Yesterday, I signed an executive action that requires masks and social distancing on federal property. Today, we'll be signing an additional executive action to extend masking requirements on interstate travel, like on trains, planes, and buses. And in light of the new COVID variants that you're learning about, We are instituting now a new measure for individuals flying into the United States from other countries. In addition to wearing masks, everyone flying to the United States from another country will need to test before they get on that plane, before they depart, and quarantine when they arrive in America. Our national plan launches a full-scale wartime effort to address the supply shortages by ramping up production and protective equipment, syringes, needles, you name it. And when I say wartime, people kind of look at me like, wartime? Well, as I said last night, 400,000 Americans have died. That's more than have died in all of World War II. 400,000. And this is a wartime undertaking. Today, I'm signing an executive action to use the Defense Production Act and all other available authorities to direct all federal agencies and private industry to accelerate the making of everything that needs to protect, test, vaccinate, and take care of our people.
David Lauder, a senior Washington writer for the LA Times. He is focusing on the coronavirus story. And I want to begin with Dr. Anthony Fauci's announcement earlier today that the U.S. is rejoining the World Health Organization. Why is that significant?
It's really significant on two grounds. One is a symbolic statement on behalf of the Biden administration that the U.S. is once again going to take a international leadership position on health issues as a way of symbolizing a broader re-engagement with the world, which is something that's important to the president, something that he's going to be pursuing on a number of fronts as a very marked change from the America First policies of the Trump administration. So that's the sort of symbolic nature of it. On the practical nature, it's a step that's potentially of a lot of importance, not so much to the U.S. As a recipient, but the U.S. as a contributor. WHO has a big role to play in ensuring that vaccines, for example, are available to countries in the developing world. The Trump administration had largely distanced the United States from those sorts of efforts, and now it's likely that the Biden administration will want to get more re-involved in those pursuits.
As you know, we reached a sobering milestone, more than 400,000 Americans who have died as a result of coronavirus this past year. And according to health experts, we are likely to reach a 500,000 at some point in February. What does that tell you in terms of where we're at and where we need to go?
Well, you know, where we're at is a pretty dire place, much worse than a lot of people thought the virus was going to be back in the spring, when people talked about 100,000 or 200,000 deaths as a bad case scenario. So we're much worse off than those projections had been. The good news is that there's some evidence that the that this wave of the virus is peaking and perhaps already has peaked and now will start going down, in part because the number of people who've been vaccinated has started to grow pretty sharply, but also in part just because at some point the virus begins to run out of people who haven't already been infected. So naturally, with all epidemics, you see a curve up and then a curve down. We may be now moving into that curve down, we hope. I think there's some evidence of that. And if the administration can succeed in getting the vaccine more widely distributed rapidly, then you could see that curve going down even faster. The big question mark and sort of ominous question mark are these new variants of the virus, which appear to be more contagious, so they would spread faster. So it's to some extent a race against the clock to get more people vaccinated before those new variants become fully established in the U.S.
Let me remind our listeners, we are talking with David Lauder of the Los Angeles Times. And let's talk about the new Biden administration, as you indicating, promising 100 million vaccines in the first 100 days, part of a $1.9 trillion relief package that includes a lot of money to deal with this pandemic. How likely is it that Congress will approve that amount?
I think there's going to be a fair amount of resistance, particularly on the part of Republicans in the Senate, to $1.9 trillion. That's a lot of money, obviously. Not all of that money goes directly to vaccinations, for example. A lot of it goes to provide various forms of income support for people who have lost their jobs, lost their livelihoods. And I think there will be a lot of argument about how much is really necessary. On the other side of the congressional equation, though, there is going to be a lot of pressure on Republicans to provide money both to help people who've lost their jobs, many of whom are constituents of Republican senators, but also to get the vaccination push moving. No one wants to be, no elected official wants to be the person who gets blamed for holding up the vaccine. So, you know, I think ultimately there's a pretty good chance that Biden will get a significant chunk of what he's asking for. He probably won't get the whole thing, and the play there is going to be sort of where the compromise ends up coming down.
David Lauder, senior Washington writer, his work available at latimes.com. We thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
On Wall Street, the Dow was off by 12. The S&P rose a fraction, the NASDAQ gaining nearly 74 points. And some new numbers on jobless claims this past week, 900,000 Americans filing for unemployment benefits. On Twitter, South Carolina Democrat Jamie Harrison writing, "I'm honored to step up as chair of the Democratic National Committee." He challenged Lindsey Graham in last November's Senate race and prior to that ran the South Carolina Democratic Party. At his first post-inauguration meeting today, the DNC party making it official, Jamie Harrison as its new chair.
Today, we are embarking upon a new mission to build back better and bring hope back to this great nation. Together, we are working to create opportunities so that more people can tell a story similar to my own. As a son of a single mom in Orangeburg, South Carolina, I didn't grow up with much. We lived with my grandparents, and even though they worked hard, we relied on food stamps and government assistance to make ends meet. My grandparents had to stop school in fourth grade and eighth grade. After I learned to read, I would sit at the kitchen table and help them read their bills each month. The words didn't always make sense to me, but their faces said everything. We didn't have the money to pay. But regardless of what we were missing, we always had our values.
That from Jamie Harrison, President Biden's pick to be the new chair of the Democratic National Committee. It was approved today. He will succeed outgoing chair Tom Perez. Earlier today, a Senate committee and a vote this afternoon in the House clearing two key paths for Lloyd Austin to serve as the next defense secretary. Congressional approval of a waiver will clear the path for his final confirmation. A law requires that officers be out of the military for at least 7 years before taking the job. General Austin retired in 2016 after a 40-plus year in career in the Army. And last night, the Senate did confirm Averill Haynes. She becomes the new Director of National Intelligence. The confirmation hearings continue for a number of the cabinet nominees. Today, former South Bend Mayor Pete Buttigieg, a 2020 presidential candidate, testifying before the Senate Commerce Committee. Montana's Democratic Senator John Tester saying that Buttigieg put on a clinic on how a nominee should work and act. And Republican Senator Todd Young of Indiana introducing him to the committee, praising his Indiana background. Here is a portion of Pete Buttigieg's opening remarks.
As a mayor from the industrial Midwest, I will bring a bottom-up perspective on transportation programs and funding. If confirmed, I'm looking forward to working with our partners at the state, local, territorial, and tribal levels as well to find solutions to our infrastructure issues while we also prepare for the future of transportation at a time of great change. When I took office as mayor of South Bend, a city built by the power of American transportation, we had been hit so hard by economic loss that some in the national press listed us as one of America's dying cities. As our city fought its way out of the teeth of the Great Recession, infrastructure was at the heart of our vision for a better future. As mayor, I worked with public and private partners to launch a smart streets initiative that brought new life to our urban core and to the historically underserved west side of our city, revitalizing our downtown, redesigning streets, and spurring hundreds of millions in major economic investment.
If confirmed, Pete Buttigieg would be the first openly gay cabinet member to serve. The Department of Transportation does distribute billions of dollars in federal highway funding. It also regulates aviation, railroads, and busing. Senator Ted Cruz, Republican of Texas, a member of the Commerce Committee, using the hearing today to criticize the new administration's decision to rejoin the Paris Climate Agreement. Here's that exchange earlier today.
I will say it was disconcerting to see yesterday, the first day of the Biden administration, straight out of the gate, President Biden announced that he was canceling the Keystone Pipeline. That is a major infrastructure project. That is a project that right now today has 1,200 good-paying union jobs. And in 2021, the Keystone Pipeline was scheduled to have more than 11,000 jobs, including 8,000 union jobs, for contracts worth $1.6 billion. And with the stroke of a pen, President Biden has told those 11,000 workers, those union workers, your jobs are gone. Mr. Buttigieg, what do you say to those workers whose jobs have just been eliminated by presidential edict?
Well, I think the most important thing is to make sure that we make good on the promise of the president's climate vision as being one that, on net, creates far more jobs, millions, we hope. I know that won't just happen. We'll have to do a lot of work to make sure that's real. But getting this right means ensuring that there are more good-paying union jobs for all Americans delivered through that infrastructure vision.
So for those workers, the answer is somebody else will get a job?
The answer is that we are very eager to see those workers continue to be employed in good-paying union jobs, even if they might be different ones.
Well, I fear that decision is the front end of a whole series of regulatory decisions, one after the other, that will be eliminating union jobs, that will be eliminating manufacturing jobs, that will be eliminating energy jobs. And that is altogether out of step with what the American people want. There is also some rich irony in the long history of the Democratic Party. There was a time when the Democratic Party, under presidents like FDR, was considered the party of union workers, of blue-collar workers, and decisions like yesterday, and I fear more decisions that we will see in the days and weeks to come, are demonstrating more and more that today's Democratic Party is not concerned with working men and women having jobs, and that the answer is we'll eliminate your jobs, and I guess good luck in the future.
Well, again, Senator, I think the answer is that we're going to create more good-paying union jobs, and we can do that while recognizing the fact that when the books are written about our careers, one of the main things we'll be judged on is whether we did enough to stop the destruction of life and property due to climate change. I've got to believe we can do both of those things. But if you and I can make common cause in our support for labor, then I think that's great news.
That's from today's Senate Commerce Committee and Pete Buttigieg, the president's nominee to serve as the new transportation secretary. He is expected to be confirmed. But questions from Republican Senator Ted Cruz. On our podcast, The Weekly, a conversation with a White House veteran from three Republican administrations. Andy Card worked in the Reagan administration, served as the deputy chief of staff under George H.W. Bush, and as chief of staff during the first 6 years of the George W. Bush administration. He knows a thing or two about presidential transitions. So as President Biden and his team now navigate these first few days in the West Wing, we asked him what the early days are really like.
It's exciting for the people who are working at the White House. They're kind of on the job for the first time, and it's unbelievably exciting, and they don't want to leave their job. And part of the responsibility of Ron Klain, the chief of staff, is to make sure people actually do go home at the end of the workday and spend some time with their families. And that's an evergreen challenge for a chief of staff. It's so exciting to work at the White House. You can be completely consumed by it and forget that you also have a family and you have to have some time for rest and relaxation, and you've got to be able to go home. Do your job, but go home and spend some time with your family, because that's how you recharge your batteries. Don't get burnt out. But Ron is coming into the job with a plan. He probably, I know he has a 100-day plan. And yes, the president will want to accomplish as much as he can in those 100 days, and he'll have a pretty good sense of what it should be. But Ron also has to have peripheral vision, not just the tunnel vision of that plan. He's got to have peripheral vision to make sure that he knows what's going on in the country, what's going on in Washington, D.C., what's going on around the world, so that he can adjust and make sure the president's priorities are consistent with the obligations of the job that day. It's not planning for tomorrow necessarily, but that day you've got to be up to the task. And there are many, as Mac McCarty used to say, UFOs, unforeseen occurrences that interrupt the plan that you had for the first 100 days or the second 200 days, and you got to be prepared to meet those UFOs when they come at you.
More of our conversation with Andy Card, his insights on life in the White House on our podcast, The Weekly. It's available wherever you get your favorite podcast, as is this program, Washington Today, and all of our coverage available online anytime at cspan.org. I'm Steve Scully in our nation's capital. Thanks for joining us. Enjoy the rest of your evening.